This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. State lawmakers have finished their reconvene. Congress has returned from spring break. The president wants to better understand your brain. So what's at the top of your politics issues list? Guns? Immigration? The sequester? Photo ID for voters? New transportation taxes? Abortion restrictions? Anything political is fair game, and you're invited to help us choose the focus. Our Kumar Gibson Roberts analysis team is here to help. U.S. Senator Tim Kaine has also agreed to chip in. The senator can only be with us for about 15 minutes at the beginning of our discussion. So if you specifically want to talk with him, please do call now. 888-WMRA-TALK. 888-967-2825. And we'll do our very best to get to your call right after the news. I'm Tom Graham. Great to be with you. This is Virginia Insight. Politics is our focus. Our analysis team of Bob Roberts, Bob Gibson, Anita Kumar here to help. But we begin with a less than 15-minute connection to Virginia's newest U.S. senator. So if you'd like to talk with Tim Kaine, please do call right away. 888-WMRA-TALK. In all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Senator Tim Kaine, great to have you back on the Inside Airwaves, sir.
Hey, glad to be on with you guys today. Thanks.
Well, Senator, the first piece of legislation that you have filed in the U.S. Senate is aimed at making things a bit easier for America's military veterans. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's the Troop Talent Act of 2013, and it basically is trying to get at this issue of why is the veteran unemployment rate higher than the national average. And there are a couple of reasons for it, but one is I don't think that our current veterans get traction back in the civilian workforce as quickly as they should, because a lot of folks in the civilian workforce are not aware of the kinds of technical and leadership training that veterans bring to the table. And so this bill really is going at the issue of when people are in active duty, can they get civilian credentials or certificates or recognition for the skills they obtain right at the moment they obtain them, that they could go in their personnel file, and then when they get ready to make the transition, that information would be right there. You wouldn't have to translate a military specialty or rank into a term that a civilian hiring officer could understand. So I'm very excited about it. We'll file it this week and expect some significant bipartisan support. And
I was just going to ask, is this one of those cases where Republicans and Democrats might not have a hard time agreeing?
I think so. I had a little test vote on it when I was working on the budget committee in March. As we were preparing the budget in committee, I wanted to create a little kind of space saving in the budget for this. I told my colleagues, Democrat and Republican, I'm going to be doing this bill in about a month. Can we create a little space in the budget for this initiative? And they were like, oh, absolutely. And while many of the votes in committee were on party lines or close to it, this one was a unanimous vote. Everybody likes the idea. And I suspect when we file, we'll have Republican co-sponsors.
We're going next to Shipman. Patricia, thanks for calling in the Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for Senator Tim Kaine, please.
Yes. Hello, Senator Kaine. I am very concerned about the recent changes in so many states, including our own, regarding voting. And I think this is the frog in the boiling water. We're not seeing how it may affect our democracy, or at least not enough people in this country are seeing it. And I know that there's been a commission that's supposed to study it, but we know that commissions are often not able to be effective in terms of changing anything. So is there something that you believe actually could work to change things back to some aspects of being able to have one person, one vote without the changes that are trying to be made in order to make it impossible for everyone to be fairly treated in voting?
Yeah, great question. You know, and there are a couple of things that we have to do, and I share your view that we benefit from robust participation and high turnout, and we want to have electoral practices and procedures that maximize the chance of that happening. And anytime there's proposals on the table that will thwart it or make it more difficult, we got to look at those with a real critical eye. The thing that I'm most concerned about right now is that I hope the Supreme Court will uphold the Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, to require preclearance of voting changes. An awful lot of voting changes that would happen in state or local governments covered by the Voting Rights Act. The fact that they have to get pre-cleared before they go into effect means that the Justice Department looks carefully at them to make sure that their intent is not to disenfranchise people. That case is pending before the Supreme Court now, and I'm very, I'm praying that the Supreme Court will continue that in place. It's a very important protection. The president has announced a commission to look at things that states are doing that might have the effect of, again, thwarting voters' intent to participate. I just was reading a memo separately at my desk on this very topic right before I got on the radio, and clearly vigorous Justice Department enforcement in Congress taking the steps that this commission suggests, making sure we communicate with state legislators and try to get them to be serious about this and not put needless blockades in people's way. All those are very, very important.
Patricia, thanks so much for your call. We're going next to our Facebook posts here, and this one, Senator Tim Kaine, is from Carolyn, who says, please ask Tim his opinion on the XL pipeline.
On Keystone. There was a vote on Keystone, kind of a test vote, I guess, as part of the budget. And it was basically to propose sense of the Senate that the White House should just go ahead and approve the Keystone Pipeline, and I voted against it. And I spent a lot of time thinking about it and doing research and getting folks in to debate it with me. And what I ended up concluding is that my longtime pitch about energy speech when I was governor used to be, we ought to do everything cleaner today than we did yesterday. We're going to use fossil fuels for a very long time. We ought to be developing non-fossil fuel alternatives. But even fossil fuels, when we use them, we should be investing in technologies that make it cleaner rather than dirtier. I supported a coal plant in Southwest Virginia when I was governor, and I did it because we made sure that the permit was going to make this the cleanest operating coal plant in the United States. And as part of the deal, we turned an existing coal plant into a gas-fired plant so it would be much cleaner. So I, in thinking about all of that, I ended up voting against the directive to pursue Keystone because I think tar sands oil, by just about any scientific account, is about 15% to 20% dirtier than conventional petroleum. And I think it kind of violates my view that we ought to be trying to do things cleaner today rather than yesterday. And so for that reason, I voted against the directive. And I believe humans affect climate, and I think we have a responsibility to deal in an economically balanced way with the reductions of carbon. Embracing dirtier technologies is going to take us the wrong direction.
Next to Harrisonburg, Nancy, your question or comment for U.S. Senator Tim Kaine, please.
Well, first of all, Senator Kaine, thank you for serving. My comment is about Medicare. I love Medicare. It works for me very well. But I would hope they would not do anything to Medicare until the issues raised in March 4th Time magazine are addressed. Stephen Brill has done an fantastic job researching medical costs. And apparently, CEOs get million-dollar salaries. They have a charge master book, even at nonprofit hospitals, that bill people with exorbitant charges. And it also mentions that nonprofits they're very limited in what they can do with their profits.
Mm-hmm.
So in some cases, they're building facilities we don't need.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'm interested in your comments on Medicare.
Yeah, well, thanks. And Medicare is such an important topic. I mean, first, it's relied upon by millions and millions of people. Secondly, it is one of the biggest items, line items in the federal budget, and it's growing at a rate that is really an unsustainable rate. So we have to figure out ways to control costs. You've given some examples, and I think there are others. So let me just mention one that's salient this week. It is the largest program in the federal government, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. Add Medicaid and Medicare together, the combined budget is bigger than defense. There has not been a Senate-confirmed administrator of this agency that millions of people rely on every day since 2006. the Senate has stonewalled repeatedly confirming a CMS administrator. A wonderful Virginian, Marilyn Tavenner, is nominated by the president to be the agency head. She's been the acting administrator for some time. I'm going to introduce her before the Health Committee tomorrow, and I think and expect that she will be confirmed. So the first thing we ought to do is, you know, we got to put somebody in to run this agency who puts patient care as the top priority, but also has significant experience in wisely controlling costs, and Marilyn does that. There are a whole series of things that we can do and that we should do in Medicare to control costs. We pay too much for prescription drugs. We made a deal when we expanded Medicare to cover prescription drug coverage, which is called Part D, in the early 2000s, that there would be no negotiation with pharmaceutical companies to get a volume discount over the drugs that we purchased. And that makes no sense. Any corner pharmacy would try to get a better deal if they purchased at high volumes, and we should be able to do the same thing in Medicare. And if we do, we'll save a lot of money, both in the budget and for seniors, without jeopardizing the quality of the program. So, you know, I think the option of doing nothing about Medicare is not on the is frankly not really an option now, because the costs are growing so significantly for a variety of reasons that we have to find ways to control it. But I maintain that you can save a lot of money in Medicare without jeopardizing the quality of the program and the care that it provides to folks who are eligible, and that's what we ought to be about.
Nancy, thank you so much for your call. Senator Tim Kaine, in the few moments we have left with you, please talk to us about guns. What do you want to happen on that issue? What do you think will actually get through Congress?
What I hope we do is, first, we need to have debates and votes. You know, there's a group of senators right now who are threatening a filibuster. And, you know, people hear the word filibuster a lot, but if you're not an insider on Capitol Hill, you might be confused about it. A filibuster is an effort to block the majority from being able to debate and vote on important measures. And there's a group of senators that want to use a filibuster to block the majority in the Senate from considering and voting upon gun safety measures. I think it's outrageous, given that a strong majority of Americans believe that we ought to put some reasonable limitations in place, that there are folks who would try to block meaningful debate and consideration. As John McCain said about the effort the other day, and I really appreciated his comment, hey, what are we afraid of? The Senate is supposed to be about debating and voting. So I want us to have that debate. I want us to fix the background record check system. So that's the most important thing. About 40% of gun sales happen to people who do not have to get their records checked. So current laws that make it illegal to possess or purchase a weapon if you're a felon, if you've been adjudicated mentally ill and dangerous, if you're a domestic violence abuser under protective order, the only way those laws can be enforced is with a vigorous background records check system. So I hope and expect that we'll vote on that bill, and I'm going to be a supporter. I also support a limitation on the supersized magazines. There's a proposal to limit magazines to about 10, no more than 10, except in certain circumstances.
Conventional wisdom seems to be saying, Sandra, that that's not going to get through.
A lot of folks are wary about whether that one will have enough votes. I think it is likely not to be in the core bill. There will be an amendment offered to add that, and if that amendment is offered, I intend to support it. And there's also going to be an amendment to ban certain kinds of assault weapons, and I'm very favorably inclined towards supporting that as well. I'm a gun owner. I believe strongly in the Second Amendment. But I believe in the First Amendment, too. I know it doesn't give a blanket protection for slander or child pornography. There's an individual right, but then there are reasonable limitations on the right to protect society, and I feel the same way about the Second Amendment. Reasonable limitations are supported by the overwhelming majority of Virginians and Americans, and if we have the opportunity to do these things and keep our kids and our community safer, I think we should.
Anita Kumar, White House correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. You got a question for Senator Kaine?
Hey, Anita.
Hi, Senator. How are you? I still get you, not used to calling you Senator as opposed to Governor. I got to get there.
As you know, I can't keep a job for very long.
I wanted to ask you, you know, as you know, and as most people know, the Supreme Court is looking at same-sex marriage.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've seen a lot of your colleagues, both mostly Democrats, even a couple Republicans, come out in support of same-sex marriage. I think there was another one today. Mm-hmm. You had a little bit of an interesting evolution, if I can call it. I mean, you've always, or for a long time, been supportive of same legal rights for same-sex couples. You did that during the campaign last year. But just recently, you actually used the word marriage, and I don't think you had done that before. I didn't know if that was for religious reasons that you didn't before, but
yeah.
I wondered why you are now comfortable with that.
Yeah, partly because I became convinced that the labels are important. As you know, Anita, and you and I talked about this. You covered this during my campaign. From the beginning of my campaign for the Senate, my position was I thought all couples should be entitled to the same legal rights. And I hope the Supreme Court rules that way. To me, it seems like that's what the Equal Protection Clause means, and I'm hopeful that's what they're going to rule. Being the lawyer, I was just really focused on that issue. I want to make sure everybody has the same legal rights, and had said in response to questions during the campaign, whether that is called marriage or civil union or anything, if it's the same legal rights, it's fine with me. But as I've talked to folks, you know, I've become convinced that the labels are not meaningless. The labels are really important. And if we use a label other than marriage, that still is going to convey a sense that there's something second class. And I just think the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause is pretty clear. I will say that my own faith and my membership in a church and the doctrines that they have, are things that I've really wrestled with over time. But even as a matter of religion and morality, separate from what the 14th Amendment says, you know, I've kind of come to the conclusion that God doesn't create anybody second class. We all ought to be entitled to the same legal rights. And so I'm very comfortable with the place now that people ought to be entitled to equal marriage rights. And I hope that the Supreme Court makes that plain.
One-time Democratic governor of Virginia, but as of this past January, U.S. Senator from Virginia, Senator Tim Kaine. Senator, great to be talking with you again. Hope we can do it again soon.
Yeah, I'll look forward to it. Thank you, guys. Everybody have a great day.
So we still have with us here on Virginia Insight our analysis panel, McClatchy Newspaper's White House correspondent Anita Kumar, also from a studio in Charlottesville, Sorensen Institute leader Bob Gibson, and here in the Insight studios in Harrisonburg, James Madison University political scientist Bob Roberts. We have a phone number for you if you want to join the discussion, responding to anything you just heard or any other issue political. 888-WMRA-TALK in all numbers translates to 888-967-2825. Hey, Bob Gibson, what did you think about what the senator just had to say about, could we call it his evolution on same-sex marriage?
Well, it does appear to be at least a linguistic evolution. I think he has long been supportive of gay rights. It's a matter of the sticking point of marriage, and a whole host of Democrats and a few Republicans, as Anita noted, have come across in the last month or two to say that gay marriage, same-sex marriage, is something that is now acceptable to them. They didn't accept that term when it was a more contentious term.
In 2006, the voters of Virginia voted to constitutionalize marriage between a man and a woman. Look at the recent polls now coming out this year, is that Virginia's public opinion has changed.
It's a massive sea change that's happening across the entire country in terms of polling. And I think the Supreme Court, without definitively ruling for all 50 states this June, is going to advance the cause again. So I think Americans are coming around to the idea that same-sex marriage is something that is acceptable in our society today when it wasn't 10 years ago.
And for the Democratic Party, it's essential because...
it has to be if you're going to get a Democratic Party nomination.
Right. And therefore, Tim Kaine is, almost all Democrats have come along, but it's amazing...
Well, Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton just a week or two ago.
So it's amazing how quickly that has changed.
Three Senate Democrats left.
Right.
Three Senate Democrats who have not yet come out in favor of
same-sex marriage.
I mean, it's changing every day. I think there was another one today.
But the issue is not over. We're going to see this issue in our governor's race in the fall.
Of course.
In a number
I got to ask, Anita, can you name off the top of your head those three senators?
I can. I'm sorry. I should have looked it up. I think it was Senator Johnson who announced today, which left. I saw people writing, and then there were three. So I remembered that it was three, but I don't
Louisiana senator, that was one.
Excuse me?
What's her the senator, Democratic senator from Louisiana.
Oh, Landrieu.
Landrieu.
Actually, she did say that she had evolved, but that the people of Louisiana don't want her to.
Right.
That's exactly right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Bob Roberts, just for the purpose of switching to another topic, It's my understanding that some of your colleagues are probably going to be upset either with you or with me. Because we did not actually have time with Senator Kaine to get to this all-important issue of the continuing resolution, something that Congress has to pass to keep the government open when they haven't agreed on a new budget. They did pass it, but in the process of passing it, thanks to Republican Senator Tom Coburn, they took out what political scientists consider all-important funding.
It's essential funding for political scientists. It's not all-important because it's funding that permits them to receive National Science Foundation grants, and many of these grants deal with politics, political behavior. And so much of the research we have out there in terms of how the electric behaves, and this research is used by all major political parties, is funded by the National Science Foundation.
So, and it amounted last year to about $10 million.
Right,
would have been $10 million in the new budget, which I think is about 0.2% of the National Science Foundation.
But in terms of what it produces a tremendous amount of information that political parties use.
Okay, so there may be hope for your colleagues in case they hadn't seen the legislation. I looked this up, and apparently there is a caveat in this elimination of this funding as written by Republican Senator Tom Coburn. What the caveat says is that the funding is eliminated except for research projects that the director of the National Science Foundation certifies as promoting national security or the economic interests of the United States.
Yeah.
I would think national security or economic interests of the U.S., any good political scientist could probably make an argument on that. So maybe we need a letter-writing campaign to the director of the National Science Foundation.
We might, but I think the criticism is, why are you singling out political scientists?
Because nobody likes you guys.
That may be the case. That may be the case.
Hey, Anita Kumar, guns going to be a big deal in Washington this week, aren't they?
Guns, is that what you asked?
I did say, yes.
Yes. Remains to be seen whether there's actually going to be a vote this week. I mean, they have Senator Reid today, the Senate Majority Leader said, could be anywhere, depending on a bunch of procedural issues, that it could be anywhere in the next week, 2 or 3 weeks. But yes, it's coming to a vote eventually here in the Senate. And Senator Kaine mentioned several of the things that are going to be in there. The biggest piece is the background check. So basically what that means is that if you are buying a gun somewhere, you'd have to go through a background check. And right now there are certain loopholes where you don't have to, certain places where you don't have to. And so this would be a universal background check. That's one of the biggest. There are a couple other pieces that he mentioned, the ammunition clips, the magazines, assault weapon ban. But those, as he indicated, are going to be separate from the big package. And so it's unclear whether they're going to get through. Also, it's really unclear whether anything is going to get through, even if the Senate votes for it. And the most likely thing is the background check. The House, it's very unlikely to get through the House. Maybe they could come up with some kind of deal, though.
It's hard to see anything getting through.
Right.
I mean, the NRA has, once again, did a somewhat masterful job manipulating public opinion. I'm sure that's not going to go well with some listeners. But in a sense, turning this debate around from gun control to a school security issue. In other words, the answer is arming teachers, putting better doors on schools, et cetera, et cetera, when the issue of gun control is a much broader issue. We have tens of thousands of Americans killed every year with guns of all types.
It's actually interesting. I did go to the NRA press conference last week, in which they had a 235-page report, or actually a task force for them did. And you're exactly right. They only addressed school issues. Not that that's not important, what buildings look like and what kind of security is there, but they wouldn't actually comment on the legislation that's pending in the Senate because they are only dealing with the one issue.
Right.
Hey, Bob Gibson, do you know any specifics that would reference what Senator Kaine was telling us about a huge majority of the American populace supporting universal background checks and limitations on large ammunition clips?
I think polling has shown that in recent weeks, that there is even a large majority among NRA members. But, of course, NRA members don't set NRA policy. So there is a large public opinion shift in favor of having universal background checks. But the NRA has switched positions and come out strongly in opposition. So it's a very difficult vote for many Republican politicians in particular. to cast in favor of universal background checks. There is a sort of a whispering campaign going on by the more right-wing gun owners of America and by the NRA that this is just an attempt by the government to register, you know, people's names so they can come after your guns, which doesn't seem to be very likely, but is a scare tactic that seems to have some public effect.
The most recent polls, and it's not just one poll, it's a variety of polls, have shown that 90%, which is a huge number,
right.
90% don't agree on anything. 90% of Americans agree that they support universal background checks.
Correct.
Our analysis panel today on Virginia Insight, White House correspondent for the McClatchy News Service, Anita Kumar, former newspaper reporter and now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson, and from the James Madison University Politics and Public Administration Department's Bob Roberts. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you've got an issue about politics that you'd like discussed, a question to ask, an opinion to offer, we've got some phone lines open for you. The number to reach any one of those lines, 888-WMRA. Talk, that's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of talk, you can reach us on our Facebook page, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Let me give a warning to our audience here. Thanks in large part to recent actions by Virginia's current Attorney General and soon-to-be Republican candidate for governor, Ken Cuccinelli, we're going to be talking about sex. So if there's anybody who thinks there are some tender ears nearby in the next couple of minutes, you may want to get those tender ears a little further away from the radio, because I'm afraid that we really can't discuss this issue without being somewhat specific. But before, so we have plenty of warning time, Anita, before we get to Ken Cuccinelli's latest concerns about the sexual behavior of Virginians, I want to hark back to something our caller Nancy was asking about Medicare, because this does touch upon something fairly controversial that's expected to come out later this week when the Obama administration reveals its budget proposals.
Yes, that's right. The budget for the White House, the president's budget, is coming out on Wednesday, and they've already revealed some of the details. It's actually a couple months late. It was supposed to come out in the first week of February. So it's coming out at a funny time, though, because the House and Senate have already started working on a budget. But his proposal is going to address entitlements, and entitlements are things like Social Security and Medicare, as you just mentioned. And the president has, since December, basically supported a proposal that would change. It's one of those awful Washington terms, change CPI. It basically means it's changing sort of the rate of inflation on some of those programs.
So if I'm on Medicare or Social Security, the rate of increases I get in the future will not be quite as large.
That's correct. And a lot of people that are opposed, and there are a good number of people are opposing, are saying it's a cut. It's a cut to Social Security. It's a cut on these programs. And there are a lot of people on the left, a lot of people that represent more progressive liberal groups, a lot of people that represent the elderly, that say, you know, there's no way around this. It's just a cut in the benefit that some of these folks get, and they are opposed.
Particularly if you do that, the cost of living index change, it does not take in consideration health care costs. And so what critics are arguing is if you take that factor out of the formula, that elderly people will see a reduced annuity every year. At the same time, they're not seeing health care costs controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they're going to get hurt. And on the other hand, if you don't do something about Medicare somehow, either raise the eligibility for it or further reduce payments to doctors and hospitals, you can't keep doing this without substantially new revenue. So I think the administration believes that this incremental change, in other words, reducing the rate of increase in Social Security payments each year, can get enough support to get through Congress, particularly enough conservative Democrats will vote for it in the Senate, and enough Republicans will vote for it in the House?
Well, I mean, this is President Obama is trying to come up with a compromise. I mean, there are many people in his party that are opposed to this proposal and perhaps some other things that are going to come out in his budget. But he has been trying for several weeks now. Some people would say it's many years too late, but he has been trying to negotiate some fiscal compromises with Republicans. He's been meeting with them, having dinner. He's having dinner again on Wednesday night with some Senate Republicans, trying to come up with some compromises on a variety of things, fiscal issues. And so this is one of the compromises he is floating out there to Republicans.
Bill Clinton did the same thing during his second term. So in
that's a very bad segue because I have to get to this thing about Ken Cuccinelli and sex. And since Bob Gibson, since we have not heard your voice in a while, not necessarily because you're the expert on this subject, or at least the only expert on the panel,
I'm going to
toss this question to you, but I'll try and do some of the heavy lifting first, so you don't have to get too graphic in your descriptions. I think it's been 10 years since the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that certain laws prohibiting sexual behavior between consenting adults were unconstitutional, that in essence you could not outlaw sexual behavior between consenting adult human beings. And after that happened, Virginia legislators considered whether or not they should get rid of what has long been known in this state, and in fact, I think is officially titled, the Crimes Against Nature Act. And basically what it is referred to, anti-sodomy laws. And
right.
and here's the sort of tender part, is that those laws prohibit behavior that many heterosexual married couples engage in, oral sex among them.
True, and yet it's viewed by the gay community as having sort of picking on them. They're the ones who feel if there is any enforcement of this type of law, it's going to come down against them more than it's going to come down against any straight couple.
Right. So, but I would suspect that there are plenty of married couple in Virginia who have not been aware that during their married lifetime they've been committing a felony. Every time they engage in certain kind of marital sexual behavior. Recently, a federal court threw out specifically Virginia's Crimes Against Nature law in a case that we don't need to go into all the details about, I don't think. But the most interesting thing about this, the reason we're discussing it now, is the man who is the presumptive Republican nominee for governor has decided to go to federal court and try and reinstate Virginia's Crimes Against Nature law.
He wants the Fourth Circuit, Court of Appeals Fourth Circuit, three-judge panel, struck it down.
Okay, so Bob Gibson...
He wants a full hearing before the Fourth Circuit.
Yeah, and why is it that the man who's going to be the Republican running for governor, who some say is going to stand a much better chance of winning if he moderates some of his positions, why is he going to federal court to make sure that a law can stay on the books that will monitor people's behavior in their bedrooms?
Well, Ken Cuccinelli, the presumptive Republican nominee, is not known for greatly moderating his positions. So it's really an attempt, I think, to continue to show the base of the Republican Party and the conservative folks in the state that he is still a true believer in the values that he and they hold dear. And if that means challenging the U.S. Supreme Court, that has never been something he's been shy of doing. You know, the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court in a Texas case 10 years ago said that this is no longer illegal does not seem to cause it to disappear as a legal case in all cases.
So if you who are listening have opinions about sex, about crimes against nature, about the federal budget, about the state budget, about guns, about immigration, about the sequester, about Medicaid, about transportation, voter ID, there's a whole host of issues we could go into, and many of them we will, but we want to make sure you know you can participate in this discussion, either with a phone call to us at 888-WMRA-TALK, or by posting on Facebook. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. You have more to say about sex?
I think the governor, I think the attorney general may attempt to use this to his advantage. I think he's going to try to argue that he's not trying to go after gays, but he's trying to protect young people. And what the Court of Appeals said to him, U.S. Court of Appeals said, if you want to protect young people from predator older individuals, write a statute to do that. In other words, you don't need to use this statute to do that. You can write a statute and get the legislature to enact it to deal with that particular problem.
So someday if I leave a life of celibacy, I may be safe in Virginia, but we don't know. actually, Anita, many of our listeners know that there's been reform going on in education in Virginia, but they don't know about the federal reform proposals, so we'll ask you about those in a moment. Bob Roberts is a professor of politics and a professor of public policy at James Madison University. Bob Gibson reported on politics at the Charlottesville Daily Progress for some 30 years before taking his current post as executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. Anita Kumar reported on Virginia politics for the Washington Post for many years, but last year switched to the McClatchy Newspaper Group, where she now serves as their White House correspondent. We've got the Kumar, Gibson, Roberts analysis team with us to review any political issue that might be of interest to you. My name, by the way, is Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Let's talk education. We may be able to get back to a review of what happened recently in Virginia for new education proposals, but I'm pretty sure nobody, Anita, has heard much about what the president is going to propose, but you have.
Right. On Wednesday, we talked about how he's going to release his budget, and so the president has a variety of new programs that are in his budget. I think you mentioned one in the opening, which is researching the brain, but also one of the ones that he has in there is a preschool program, and he wants...
A preschool program?
Yeah. So this is for young kids, particularly low-income kids. He wants to be able to go to preschool. A public preschool. Obviously, there needs to be a price tag to that, but if he wants the government to pay. For folks in Virginia, that might sound slightly familiar because Senator Kaine, when he was governor, championed this idea. He really tried to get the General Assembly to fund this program. It was a pilot program, and he wanted to expand pre-K, and he didn't have a whole lot of luck with getting Republicans to go along with that. So we'll see if President Obama does. I don't have the number in front of me exactly how much he wants to spend on that, but I will tell you that he has signaled that he wants to pay for it with an increase in tobacco products. So cigarettes prices would be raised to pay for this preschool program.
Is it accurate to say that the president's view is every parent who wants to should be able to send their child to preschool?
Yes, I believe that's his view, but he particularly wants those that are in lower income or disadvantaged homes or communities to be able to, they should definitely be able to go.
See, Head Start apparently covers a lot of those, but the eligibility for Head Start is pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
So what he's trying to do is raise that, like Tim Kaine wanted to, raise that eligibility level up, which is very expensive, and therefore that he wants to basically follow Tim Kaine's model.
I know. It's interesting we didn't get a chance to ask him about that, but I wonder, you know, as many people know, Tim Kaine, Senator Kaine and President Obama are friends. I actually wonder if he got that idea from him.
I would be surprised.
888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number, but if you prefer all numbers, that translates to 888-967-2825. Next is Stanton. Bill, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
I'm interested to know what the panel thinks of the governor's relationship with Star Scientific and similar relationships by Congressman and Mrs. Cantor with Goldman Sachs and Cuccinelli with Star Scientific. And, of course, we can't forget Senator Tommy Norman and Dominion Power. I'd like to listen in to hear what you say.
Anita, you have some news about Star Scientific and the governor and the governor's daughter's wedding.
I do. For those who aren't familiar with this, my former paper, The Washington Post, published a series of articles in the last couple weeks talking about both the attorney general and the governor's relationship with this company, Star Scientific, which produces a kind of dietary supplement. So the governor has been friends with the head of that company. His name is Johnny Williams. He's the chief executive at the company. And you know, in Virginia, where there's not a lot of campaign finance rules, donors can give any amount of money they want to state candidates. So they could give Governor McDonnell any amount they wanted. And so this company and this CEO did give him quite a bit of money, did, I think, take him on some plane rides, or perhaps that was the attorney general. But the news that came out recently was that Mr. Williams paid for Governor McDonnell's daughter's part of her wedding reception. He paid for the caterer. And that was about $15,000. And it turns out that the governor and his wife have been helping this company publicize their products. And so there've been
this company, by the way, is facing a court battle over some $700,000 in state taxes that the company says it should not have to pay. And Virginia, at least at one point, was saying it should have to pay. We may be able to get to that in a moment. But part of the news here, Anita, is that back at the time of the governor's daughter's wedding, you asked the governor's spokespeople whether Star Scientific contributed anything to pay for any part of the wedding.
Well, I didn't ask specifically about this company because we didn't have any idea that they were donating. But what I did ask, and I wrote about the wedding, and the reason I did was because it took place at the governor's mansion. And so they were doing a lot of things on this very historic building. And so this was in 2011, and I did ask about the payment. Who was paying for this event that was happening in a public building? And I was told that the family was paying for all the costs and that there were no donations. And that now they are acknowledging just in the last couple of weeks, the governor's office, that in fact the caterer, $15,000, was paid by this donor.
So they fibbed.
Well, they did something. They didn't tell the truth then, or I mean, they've definitely changed their story. It was very clear before that the family was paying, and now they have been very clear that this donor did pick up the tab. It's interesting. In Virginia law, you have to, if you're a public official, you have to, if you're the governor, you have to say who paid, you know, if you've gotten any donations. And there are forms for that. But if the governor's daughter or the daughter's now husband received a donation, they do not have to disclose that. And so there was no accounting for that a year ago or 2 years ago.
Bill, thank you so much for your call. But speaking of Governor McDonnell on a quite different issue, we got sort of last-minute notice a week ago that he could be with us. We weren't sure up until almost broadcast time that he would be able to. And in the 10 minutes or so that we had him on the line, I fired off a bunch of questions to him on different issues. And I was just about to ask him about his view on expanding Medicaid when we got this.
With regard to Medicaid expansion, which may be your next question, I don't believe we should expand Medicaid currently. We ought to have a good safety net. We ought to take care of the poor, blind, and aged and disabled, which we do now in Virginia. But expanding our rosters by 450,000 people at a time when Medicaid is already a budget buster, and by that I mean literally, it's 1,600% growth in 30 years, from 5% to 21% of the total budget. And so my position is we have to have dramatic and serious, longstanding reform of our Medicaid system to have more accountability and more cost savings before we can even consider expansion. And I think that's what the language in the budget does, is kind of create that firewall against expansion without reform.
Governor, are Democrats in the state Senate under the impression that they have a deal with you that would allow Medicaid expansion under the new federal law?
Well, they put some language into the budget that doesn't do what they think. There's some language in the budget that the House and Senate agreed to, Republicans and Democrats in the conference committee, that essentially says what I just said, and that is that it is a reform-first approach. And they added that to the conference committee to say that a subset of the General Assembly would determine whether or not reforms were actually being implemented and done and successful before there's any Medicaid reform, I mean, Medicaid expansion. So I think some are saying, well, we've clearly got a path to Medicaid expansion, but that would not be accurate.
Okay, so now that we have established that Virginia's governor, Bob McDonnell, is psychic because he knew which question I was going to ask him next without my giving him any hint. But the other thing, Bob Gibson at the Sorensen Institute, did Democrats in the General Assembly get snookered here? Did they think they had a deal that was going to lead to Medicaid expansion and then, aha, the governor said no?
They had a deal, but it depends on things, and it depends on something that we're not really up on knowing the details of, which is the extent to which Medicaid rules for Virginia are relaxed or reformed. And I don't know that anyone on this show has a good list of what those rules and reforms might be that would give Virginia the Medicaid expansion that Democrats in the Senate thought they were getting in the agreement with the administration at the last minute. This was added in last-minute negotiations over the successful transportation bill, which the Democrats were key to giving votes to the governor for to get it passed. It was truly a bipartisan transportation funding bill.
And that was sort of the important part of the deal, wasn't it? The Democrats said, we will vote for your transportation plan if you promise us to give a pathway to Medicaid expansion.
And a pathway was created. Now, the details of that pathway are unknown to me and unknown to most of the people that I've talked to about this situation.
Well, there was a surprise since we talked to the governor this past Wednesday's reconvene session. He actually stuck in an amendment that caused some consternation, but actually passed. Bob Roberts, has to do with abortion. Explain, please.
Under the Obamacare, to get the Senate to approve it and Congress to approve it, there was a revision allowing each state to ban abortion coverage for the exchanges. So that was all.
These are the health care exchanges.
Correct.
Where, as of next year, people who are not covered by their employer will be able to purchase health care.
Medicaid
insurance
now doesn't pay for abortions.
Okay.
So this was for the exchanges. By a vote of one vote margin in the Senate, it passed the Senate, passed the House. So Virginia is now not going to allow abortion coverage in any health insurance policies issued pursuant to the exchanges. Even though these exchanges technically in Virginia, which becomes an interesting legal question, are theoretically to be operated by the federal government. So this makes it even more bizarre because Virginia has not agreed to offer these plans. These plans are going to be offered by the federal government, but Virginia wants to regulate the federal plans. This gets even more bizarre. The politics of this, but clearly
it sounds like clearly there's going to be a court challenge.
I really don't think so, because under the law as I've studied it, the state can do this with or without taking responsibility for the exchanges. So there may be a court challenge, but the nuance here is these are going to be federally operated health plans, but regulated by the state of Virginia. Virginia claims it has the authority to regulate them, even though these are federally operated exchanges, health plans.
And the argument that opponents of the governor's position on this are making is that what you're saying to a private business, a health insurance company that participates in these exchanges, is we, the government, are going to limit what you can offer for
sale. Correct,
Anita, we had a question earlier in the hour from Patricia, back when we were talking to Senator Kaine, about voting rights. The governor also talked a little bit about why he now supports photo IDs in Virginia for voters. But I'm curious, have you been hearing anything in the White House about their level of concern about state governments run by Republicans around the country, trying to make it a little bit more difficult to vote?
Well, it's interesting you should mention that. I think it was just maybe a week or two ago that the president said that he was going to form a commission to look at voting issues. Now, a variety of those issues he's talking about are, if you can remember back to November, because this happened in Virginia as well as some other states, including Florida, there were huge lines. People were waiting for hours to vote, and there were all sorts of logistical problems around the country. And he has said more than once that's unacceptable. And he wants a bipartisan commission to look at those issues. I suspect that a lot of that, or at least some of that, is going to look at some of these states that have enacted some restrictions, like Virginia, to see what kind of difference that made. I mean, part of it is if you have new changes or you have changes and the poll workers aren't well-versed in that, or more importantly, the voters aren't. They don't know what to bring. They didn't bring the right thing. That could also also deal with that. And I think Senator Kaine also mentioned that the Obama Justice Department, or maybe he didn't mention it, but the Obama Justice Department has been looking at some of these states that have enacted new restrictions.
The one area there in Washington, Anita, where it seems like Republicans and Democrats may get together and, if not hold hands, at least not scream at each other, is immigration.
Well, maybe, but they're still working on it. So it's true that some Republicans and some Democrats have gotten together. There's a group in Washington. There's always a gang of senators doing something. So there's a group, a gang, if you will, of senators looking at immigration. And they are working on a proposal. It was supposed to maybe come out this week, but now that looks like it's going to be delayed a week or two. They're still working on some of the finer points. But basically, I think there are a lot of people, both parties and Congress and the White House, that think the issue of what to do with people who are here illegally, they came to the United States illegally, how to sort of deal with that. I mean, that's a lot of people. But there are also a lot of other issues, work visas and things like that. And so I think that they are trying to come up with a plan. The question, of course, is what's going to get through Congress. And just like on the gun thing, there's one sticking point is how long and, you know, where do they have to go? People that are here illegally, you know, how long do they have to wait before they could, you know, get their papers to be here legally, become citizens, and what do they have to go through? And so those are that's the big sticking point.
Bob Gibson, last topic in the half minute or less we've got left. What's going to happen next in the governor's race in Virginia?
We're going to be hearing a lot of things. You know, one of our callers today raised the point about Attorney General Ken Cuccinelli and Star Scientific, and that has been in the news in the last several weeks, and he's backed away from the tax case in which Star Scientific may owe the state as much as $1 million or more dollars in tax liability. So you'll be hearing a lot about Star Scientific and its relationship to the Attorney General, and you'll be hearing a lot about green car companies and their not producing jobs. The green car company that was brought to Mississippi by Terry McAuliffe, who has backed away from that company and backed away from its claims of job creation.
So we've got more fun stuff to look forward to talking about. Our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, McClatchy Newspaper's White House Correspondent and Charlottesville native Anita Kumar, plus earlier in the program, Virginia's junior U.S. Senator Tim Kaine. Many thanks all for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about all of our guests. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.